listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, a report on two of the wars that are raging on the African continent. This was a press briefing delivered by Bintou Keita, Assistant Secretary General for Peacekeeping Operations at the UN, after a recent visit to South Sudan and Ethiopia.
Thank you very much. So I just returned from South Sudan, and at the time where I went there, it was a very crowded place, which in some ways meant that it is a place of attention, and I think it rightly so. When I visited South Sudan, we had the AUPSC who was visiting for several days, South Sudan. We also had the Fifth Committee visiting, and we also had the special envoy of IGAD visiting South Sudan. And in that, my main purpose and objective for the visit was to review with the mission, the new implementation of the new mandate for the mission, and at the same time look at interacting with most of the government officials, including also the opposition leaders, the peace process. And at the time where I was going, the high-level revitalization forum was meant to take place from 26 April to 30th of April. So that was my main objective. And I also didn't just stay in Juba. I also visited Wau and Rumbek in a way to understand better the challenges on the ground, and particularly looking at protection of civilians in Wau, and also interacting with local government officials and civil society organizations all the same. In Rumbek, this was a very interesting place, not because of the usual fight that we see between armed group and the government, but mainly because this is a place where intercommunal violence is extremely high. And in that, I was told as a way to point and go there, that there was one incident in December where 207 people were killed in the context of this intercommunal violence, and 105 people were injured. So I was trying to understand what we, in the context of Rumbek and the field, could do in support of people-to-people talk and type of reconciliation in the context of reduction, reducing the intercommunal violence. I met the first Vice President Thabo Mbeki in Juba. And in that meeting, what I was trying to assess was the degree of views and optimism around the high-level revitalization forum. And clearly, what I was told already at that time was the decision was to postpone the high-level revitalization forum because the divergent views and positions between the warring parties were too far apart to enable any meaningful conversation if the peace talks were moving as scheduled and planned. For that, what I can say is that we, as the United Nations, in support of the African Union, but also the sub-regional level of interaction, are fully committed to support IGAD and the High-Level Revitalization Forum. And actually, and when I was there, it was very interesting because a number of members, be it from the civil society organization or women and youth leaders and elderly, but also the diplomatic community and the UN country team, agencies, funds and programs were quite adamant that this was the only way out in terms of implementing the peace agreement from 2015. So though there was some disappointment and frustration around the postponement of the talks to 17 now May to 21st of May, everybody is rallying behind this as the way forward. While I was there, there was still fighting going on. So you all know about the cessation of hostilities that was brought forward through the IGAD-led process back in December. The CITISAM, in the context of the work that the mission, the UNMISS is doing, is to support the CITISAM from a logistic perspective, as well as ensuring the support, which also lead to the technical type of expertise which is provided to the CITISAM. And if we were to push further, the mission is also very much engaged in two other streams that are clearly important as part of the process of trying to rally and promote a peaceful coexistence in the country, having to do with the national dialogue, where, again, the mission is providing support, but also providing support to what we call the people-to-people talk at community level. And this is completely relevant in relation to what I have explained to you with the intercommunal violence, which is also as a result of some of the difficulties of the people coming all together. Now, it's also clear that one of the elements which was brought into the mix from the government officials had to do with, if the peace talks in the high-level revitalization forum are not going through as planned and we are not able to reconcile the views, how do we then have another way to look at exiting the situation and the dire situation in which the country finds itself. And this is also one place where we had, as a United Nations, to be very clear in the Department of Peacekeeping Operation to say, if there is a plan B, this is not a genuine engagement in going through the motion of the high-level revitalization forum. So in that, prospect from within the capital is to move to elections, and it is very clear to us that this is not at all, from an economic perspective, from a political perspective, from a humanitarian perspective, a country where it is conducive right now to go through any meaningful elections in as a plan B. So for us, there is no plan B. The only plan is the high-level revitalization forum. I also attended what we have called the high-level dialogue, leadership dialogue around conflict-related sexual violence and sexual and gender-based violence. And in that, the purpose was to use the visit to redynamize or to rekindle commitments that were made in 2014 through the leadership of the special representative of the Secretary General in conflict-related sexual violence, Mrs. Bangura, at the time, with all the parties in South Sudan, which kind of went a bit dormant, though there was a high level of commitment from the Minister of Gender, Women and Child Welfare, as well as a commitment at the president's level to have a focal point dealing with the provision of the action plan to advance the issues of tackling the element of emergency and impunity and prosecution and of the perpetrators of sexual and gender-based violence and conflict-related sexual violence. So we had this leadership dialogue, which in my view was a success in the sense that not only the minister mobilized the cabinet and the focal point from the president, but we had the diplomatic community and the UN country team present, including a number of civil society organizations and community-based organizations who took the floor, and religious leaders who clearly, in my view, have to become much more vocal about the fact that the situation in that is absolutely not acceptable. In Addis, I also participated in what is called the TANA Forum. And the two elements that I want to leave with you is the theme of the forum was African issues for African solutions, with a view to provide a greater sense of ownership to the African countries themselves. And I think this is the right direction to go. And in that, my main goal was to look at the situation on the continent, because most of our peacekeeping operations, the largest, are on the continent. I can give you a number of data that are supporting this. But clearly, to have now the African Union and a number of personalities, including Obasanjo, who is one of the founders of the TANA Forum, talking about pushing the African member states and countries to take responsibility, I think is a right way to go. The second element which I took from TANA Forum has to do with everything related to what is happening with the Lake Basin Chad and the difficulties around it and the disappearance of it and the impact it has on the livelihoods of hundreds of thousands of people, and how this is has to be connected or interconnected to what we call the peace and security pillar with the development pillar, as well as some of the aspects of the human rights pillar interconnected into providing a response. And I also attended a discussion in Addis, what was called the first ever high-level dialogue between African Union and the Office of the Human Rights Commission, co-chaired by the AU chairperson and the High Commissioner of the Human Rights. And the theme was around how do we ensure that there will be a much stronger compliance framework in relation, at least from my perspective, in the context of the peace support operations in Africa. But there were much more discussions around racism and xenophobia and all kinds of things that are forthcoming in the context of the migration and the mobility of people around the continent, but also, of course, the world. And finally, I also attended the high-level, what is called the African Women Leaders Network, African Women for Africa, in the sense that there is a vision from the African Union on the Agenda 2063, which is about the Africa we want. So how do we get there? It's also having the aspect of the women, peace and security coming into the play of the stakeholders who have to act on the issues that are confronted by the continent. And in there, I think we had very interesting discussions, but my main advocacy is that for women, peace and security agenda, what we need men, more men, to be sensitive and champion, and not thinking that because it is about women issues, then it is the women only who have to talk about the women, peace and security agenda, because for me, it's about the society, and it's about the community, and it's about the world affairs, where we need the women, peace and security to kick in really, and not just paying lip service to it.
Thanks very much. We'll open up the floor for questions. Yes.
Thank you very much, Edith Lederer from the Associated Press, and thank you on behalf of the United Nations Correspondents Association for doing this briefing. I have a couple of questions related to the issue of the Revitalization Forum. First of all, when you said that for the UN there is no Plan B, it is the Revitalization Forum, what was the reaction from the government officials that you spoke to? Did they offer any ways to try to reduce the differences between the parties, and is your sense that they've ruled this out entirely or just postponed it?
First of all, I think the postponement comes from the IGAD. And the IGAD, because they really are trying their best, their level best, to try to reduce the gaps between the warring parties in terms of the positions. And they had a plan, which is actually ongoing, which is to have a shuttle diplomacy between Addis and South Sudan, and including at some point they will be going to Pretoria in order to engage Riek Machar. And I think it's a wise way to look at not just having a meeting for having a meeting and then ticking a box and saying we have had the meeting, but to acknowledge that actually the parties are so far apart that there is a need to have some kind of homework in order to arrive at the 17 May with the parties having reflected a bit more on the possibility to come to a common ground. This is how I would be framing it. So the government reaction, so to respond again to your questions, was when we were very clear that there is no Plan B, because they told us, we can organize election between 3 and 6 months. We said, well, even in places where it is extremely well organized, there is no way that you can go through all the steps of preparing election in the conditions that we are seeing now. So they were a bit dubitative because they think that they can just maybe with a magic wand organize these elections. My sense is still, when I was in Addis and I interacted with some of them, including later not in that meeting, my sense is that they are still engaging. They are still dialoguing. And I think we should encourage this. The worst which can happen is that people stop talking to each other and not engaging.
So when would you envision a possible revitalization forum meeting taking place? Are you talking about months or weeks?
So far, the chattel diplomacy is, just to give you an idea, so when I was there, the high-level revitalization forum was planned from 26 to 30th. Right. Then it was pushed back to 2nd or 3rd of May. Then to 8th of May. And now it's 17. And I think this, in view of the positions of the parties, seems to be much more realistic. And with the engagement of the state minister of Ethiopia, foreign minister, whom also I met in Addis, and others, the councils of ministers who are engaging in this chattel diplomacy, including the special envoy of IGAD, Mr. Weiss, I think we have better chance. And the fact that we have a number of international community members also engage the diplomatic community to all pass the same message. Please come to a place where there is a genuine engagement to continue and have a...
And one final follow-up on elections. Do you think that this remains the goal of the government quickly? That they still want elections in 3 to 6 months?
I have to say that after the exchange, my view was this is not going to happen tomorrow. So, and with the position of the international community, I believe we will have to go through the process of maybe in next iteration later. This will be maybe more conducive environment for that.
Mr. Badi?
Thank you, Madam Assistant Secretary General, for this briefing. My name is Abadi from the paper Le Dossier. You spoke about peace and security, about diplomatic activity, about elections, about the role of IGAD, of the African Union, of the potential role of the civil society. What is the role in here for the Political Affairs Department? How much consultation have you had with the department, and to what extent you coordinated your trip with it?
Well, interestingly, one of the way to prepare any visit, first of all, I don't see a separation between department when it comes to a file, a specific file, and in this case, South Sudan. The discussions which have led to why South Sudan, I think, were a collective view of how do we support the African Union and its sub-regional organization in support to South Sudan. And in that, there is no separation DPA, DPKO. We have what we call the African Union UNOAU, based in Addis, who was our point of entry in organizing and facilitating some of the meetings that we had, of course, with the mission in Juba, but also some of the meeting with the opposition leaders and the AUPSC members, including the P5, for Addis. So I don't see separation. I see a collective endeavor in order to try to support a country-led process with our support from the regional organization.
Matthew Lee, InterCity Press, on behalf of the Free UN Coalition for Access. Thanks for this briefing. You mentioned WOW, and I wanted to ask you, just as a DPKO official, can you give either an actual update or why there's not yet an update in terms of the allegations of sexual exploitation against the Ghana UN police unit there? It seems to, like, I know that they keep saying that they were removed, but what has actually taken place in terms of investigating it? And a question I'd hoped to ask Fairheim, but I'll ask you. There have been a letter to Mr. Lacroix from Tamil organizations in Sri Lanka about the deployment of peacekeepers, quote-unquote peacekeepers, who were alleged to have engaged in summary executions in Sri Lanka. And there's been a second letter, May 1st, and I wanted to know, they seem to believe that they haven't gotten a response, and they've named particular commanders and said that there's – and I'm just wondering, where does it stand in terms of DPKO addressing the pretty troubling concerns raised by these groups about the lack of vetting of peacekeepers deployed by DPKO? Thanks.
Okay, so you had two questions.
WOW and the Sri Lankan.
Okay, so I went to WOW, and my main goal in WOW was to interact with the community in the POC site, in the Protection of Civilian site. And in there, I met with the women, and some of the questions came in terms of where we are with the investigation. And just to be very blunt with you, the OIOS investigation is still ongoing, and we are waiting for the results. The results are going to be shared with Ghana as a country, because this is part of the way the Memorandum of Understanding with the Foreign Police Unit is organized. And in the meantime, I have to say the government officials in WOW, the local government whom I met, they didn't discuss with me immediately. But what they did, which I found was very diplomatic, was they wrote a letter, and in the letter at the end, they said, okay, can you provide a status on where we are with the investigation? And the woman also asked where we are with the investigation. So I'm just telling you where we stand. The OIOS process, independent-led process, is going on. Once we have it, it's going to be shared with the country. And for the follow-up actions, which will be depending on what the facts are, we can only reiterate again once more that in the context of the mission, all the precautionary measures and education, awareness raising, and training are provided on a regular basis, including banners that are displayed everywhere in the mission. And I've seen it. So it's not that I read it in a report. I've seen it. And even people carrying their no excuse card and showing me their no excuse card for sexual exploitation and abuse. And the second question, the letter that you are referring to, I know that the department is looking into what has been provided to us, and there will be a response in due time.
Yes, Mr. Badi.
Thank you. Thank you for the briefing. My name is Abdul Hamid Sayam from the Arabic daily Al-Quds Al-Arabi. Last Friday, the MINURSO mandate was extended only for 6 months. This is a precedent. The U.S. Representative said this is a textbook of a frozen conflict. There are many other frozen conflicts like UNIFIL, Cyprus, UNDOF and Golan Heights, and many others. So what is your vision of how to address these frozen conflicts and have the mandate reactivated in a different way? There will be achievements, there will be results, there will be consequences. They come back to the Security Council and say, we achieved this. We don't need to extend the mandate beyond this year or that year. Thank you.
So I'm trying to frame the question in such a way that I understood it. So is a question specific to MINURSO? It's
to the frozen conflict where these peacekeeping missions stay forever.
Okay.
Like 64 in Cyprus, 78 in South Lebanon, 48 in Unmogib in Pakistan and India. All these years and these peacekeeping observation mission or missions are sitting there doing nothing. What could be done about it?
Well, if I may, I will reframe this way. The question for me to ask is, if they were not there, what would happen? Because from my understanding and the way I've been looking at it, I took this position in early November. And so I'm looking across the 15, now we are 14 because UNMIL has closed on 30th of March this year. When I'm looking across, the rhetoric that it is it because there is no peace process moving, then they are doing nothing. I would say that we will need to reframe this because all the reduction of violence, skirmishes, etc., which can escalate, actually, they are dealt with by the peacekeepers, by the mission. So, in other words, for me, they have their value, and they are rendering and performing on the basis of what is going on there. Now, we also had it on the 28th of March, the open debate on partnership for peacekeeping and action for peacekeeping. And I think one of the questions that we should be asking is at the Security Council, the member states, when we say they are frozen because of what? Because of the dynamics that are going on at local, regional, sub-regional, which have to do with politics. So, and this is not the mission is a tool at one point to support a political process. So how do we get this right and not what I will call sometimes using the mission as a scapegoat? Sorry for using this term, but because it is a shared responsibility, so the performance of the mission has to be looked at with the performance of all the stakeholders.
That was Bintou Keita, Assistant Secretary General for UN Peacekeeping Operations in South Sudan and Ethiopia, speaking at the UN on Wednesday.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
In case you didn't know, it is May Day today.
Day protests in France have turned violent, forcing police to use tear gas and water cannons and arrest more than 200 protesters.
Corruption, they see as endemic across the board.
May Day protests in support of workers' rights turned violent in cities around the world.
As the tear gas settles and rain washes blood from the streets of Europe after this week's global May Day uprising, I'm Afshin Ratansi, and this is a Going Underground special. With me for the whole program is legendary journalist and filmmaker John Pilger. John, let's start and go straight to austerity before we go to foreign policy. You've been in Australia, I know, another first world country. The levels of austerity been beaten since the 2008 crash?
Austerity is applied globally. So the same policies of extreme tax cuts that Trump is imposing on the United States that we've had in this country for a very long time, it's called neoliberalism, they apply. So you have what is called an underclass, people working on temporary visas for low wages. This has become the pattern in all rich countries. It's a kind of Darwinian economics that those who've two-thirds society, those who've got it, do really well. Those in the middle who aspire to do well are usually in debt, and those in the bottom are discarded.
And yet, of course, while, as you say, these two-thirds have been suffering since 2008 or even before then, there is money for wars. What was your reaction when you first heard of the Anglo-American-French missile attacks on Syria?
It's built on a series of, I would call them, lies, fabrications.
The chemical attack on Douma, Theresa May clearly said, this is why Britain has to go in and fire.
I don't think anything Theresa May says is to be believed, frankly. She's yet to convince us that she has a right to be believed, because almost everything to do with foreign policy has shown to, in the end, if you take the Salisbury attack, that is unraveling so fast. For example, the OPCW report on this, which is not reported, include a laboratory report from its major laboratory in Switzerland, which said this wasn't a nerve agent, this wasn't Novichok, it was something entirely different.
You're talking about the Wiltshire attack.
We're talking about the Wiltshire, the Salisbury attack, but they are connected, because it leads then to the attack on Syria. There is overall a campaign against Russia. This is a very long campaign. It's been going on since the Russian Revolution. But it's intensified in terms of its propaganda in a way I've never known. I've never known journalism to be so distorted in order to serve this propaganda. I mean, the attack on Douma was based on, when I called it a lie, when you look at the available evidence, the real evidence, the evidence that barely sees the light of day, then there's no justification for it whatsoever. There's no real evidence of a chemical attack. So what we're seeing is the most intense campaign of propaganda, at least since the build-up to the Iraq War in 2003. It comes from a great tradition. It comes from 1945, the cover story for dropping two atomic bombs, later discredited, right through to the beginning of the Vietnam War, the Gulf of Tonkin. So we had years of misery and devastation in Vietnam built on a lie. When are we going to understand this? When are we going to understand there's an historical pattern? And we're seeing that played out now almost through the propaganda that's presented as news.
I think one could argue that many mainstream media journalists have short-term memories, perhaps, but they are handed, as they have always been handed, press releases from government that routinely say Russia has obviously invaded an area of Europe, and now they're being told we have proof that they have launched a chemical attack on English soil, first time since World War II. And the journalists say our governments cannot possibly be lying about such a serious event.
I've been a journalist for a long time. I've covered many wars. I've covered the First Cold War. I've covered it from the Soviet Union. I've covered it from the United States. I've worked all over the world. I'm a reporter. I would say there is a pseudo-journalism now. The kind of journalism you described, I wouldn't describe as journalism. To simply write down and swallow what governments tell you is the very antithesis of what real journalism is. Fortunately, we still have it in the great honorable exceptions, the mavericks, like Robert Fisk, whose single report from Douma showed almost without doubt the whole thing was a farce. He interviewed a doctor who'd worked at this particular facility. There was no evidence. The doctor made a mockery of Macron's and May's and claims. We have Seymour Hersh now, who can't be published in his own country. He has to be published in Germany. probably the greatest investigative reporter in the world, Hirsch, last year, his own reporting, his own investigation, made mockery of these so-called chemical attacks. I've never known a time when so-called, as you describe it, mainstream, surely a satirical term, mainstream journalism has been so integrated into a propaganda barrage. And that propaganda campaign, at the moment pointed right against Russia, suggests to me that it's the beginning of a kind of another march on Russia. That the surrounding of Russia with bases, with American bases, with NATO missiles, the provocations day after day suggest this. In Syria, where basically the Russians and the Syrians have succeeded, they've won. The rebels, most of whom are jihadists and extreme Islamicists, supported by the United States, supported by Britain, are still presented as a credible opposition within Syria. But the whole point of this is to take Syria from the Russians since the 1950s. If you read the documents, you go back and read the declassified MI6 dispatches from Syria. They've been trying to do this since the 1950s. Syria hasn't been controlled in the same way that Iran hasn't been controlled. I hope this is not the last stage. I don't think it is, because in Syria, it appears there's a major defeat. And what we're seeing is a reaction to that.
But of course, you mentioned some world-renowned journalists. Have you been surprised about how they have been taken as apologists for Putin and for Assad by presenting the opposite narrative?
No, of course not. I've been called everything throughout my career. That's a badge of honour. You're a good reporter only if at some point authority, established forces about whose nefarious activities and invasions you're writing label you a dupe. That used to be a favorite, or an apologist. Robert Fisk knows this very well. It's happened with every great story he's reported. And I say great story because his reporting has been of the highest order since I've known him. As with Seymour Hersh, as with people like Gareth Porter, great investigative reporter, who you'll never see, he's an American, you'll never see in a so-called mainstream newspaper, he writes on the net. But read his material about Iran. It's based on fact.
You mentioned Iran. How serious is this narrative now going to twist away, well, maybe while still remaining on Syria, but going to focus on some kind of imminent war on Iran, especially as we know John Bolton is now National Security Advisor and Donald Trump...
Well, it's John Bolton and this man, Mike Pompeo, who's the Secretary of State. It's hard to know who amongst them is the most extreme. But Iran has been a major target, much more so than Syria, much more so than Iraq, because Iran was one of the pillars of Western power, American power in the Middle East. And when Mossadegh, the democratically elected leader of Iran, was overthrown in the 1950s by Britain and the United States, and the Shah was installed, that was when the pillar was reinforced. But the pillar collapsed in 1979 with the revolution in Iran. And that has never been forgiven. Getting Iran, the major ambition at the moment, that's why we're coming to a very dangerous period when Trump must ratify the agreement that Obama signed with Iran, along with the EU, under which Iran committed itself, as it frankly always had, committed itself to a peaceful nuclear program. In return, sanctions were dropped, and so on. We have dangers, you know, dangers that are presented to us that are so unnecessary. Why are we threatening countries like Iran, which hasn't invaded anyone for about 400 years, that don't threaten us? Why is anachronism like Israel allowed to have its impunity? Why do we, as you have described, journalists write down what governments tell us? Why don't they question them? Don't they? It's just a few years ago that all those terrible mistakes happened in 2002, 2003, that led to the disaster of the invasion of Iraq. Why is this being repeated? These are questions that demand to be answered, not just by journalists, but by the public in democracy, particularly in countries that still regard themselves as democratic.
John Pilger, I'm going to stop you there. More from John Pilger after the break. Welcome back. I'm still here with legendary journalist and filmmaker John Pilger. John, did you ever expect to see what looked like detente in Korea?
No, I didn't expect it. Although I should have expected it. The Koreans themselves, if we've been following them, and we don't follow them, we follow the big powers that impose themselves, particularly in the United States, on that country. It's a very popular move by the president of South Korea. I would have thought it's clearly a popular move in North Korea. Korea is one of the most homogeneous societies in the world. I mean, you can find very few countries that are so, it's almost like everyone's related, it's one big family. The idea of them divided is absurd. They recognize that. But what this demonstrates is that a regional solution is possible, not only possible, it's probably the only way to all the world's so-called flashpoints and problems.
But the credit is being given to Donald Trump's administration.
Oh, yeah, well, they've even wanted to give him the Nobel Peace Prize. Why not? Given to a few others.
Your film, Coming War in China, details that massive military expansion in that area.
Yes.
And so obviously not everyone is celebrating because the share prices of all Boeing, Raytheon, Lockheed and others have gone down. How can these regional peace deals be done in the face of all of that military industrial complex power?
Well, this deal is being done, and I think both Koreas have to be very careful of not walking into a trap as well. The trap could be that North Korea is disarmed completely, and North Korea knows that by having nuclear weapons, that's prevented it from being another Iraq, another Libya, from being attacked. I don't think there's any question about that. So while it's desirable that North Korea is disarmed of nuclear weapons and all of Korea is denuclearized, it also has to be de-Americanized. The two, in fact, the former is rather more important than the latter. How that happens is going to be the very tricky part of the negotiations coming up, because Korea, as far as the United States is concerned, is really a front line on a number of countries, but especially a front line on China. Borders Russia and China, of course, but it has its THAAD, so-called anti-missile system, which is said to be pointing at the north, No one believes that. It's pointing at China. So these are very precarious days ahead, but I think they're quite hopeful days.
I'm not sure if you still have friends in the national security apparatus of the United States, but do you think there are people in there taking a rather dim view?
Very dim, and will oppose this. As you point out, all the arms companies will oppose this. Although the Japanese have said publicly they support it, but, and I've no doubt the Japanese people support it, no question about that. But whether the United States stays in Korea, literally leaves, is the crucial factor here. That will really mean the end of the Korean War.
Surely there are interests, and we should remind people who don't, because it's seldom mentioned here, that of course Britain was involved in killing of 20% of the population of Korea. How far would the United States go in trying to remain there if peace breaks out?
I don't know, but for them, it may all get out of control. This will become so popular, if it isn't already in Korea, that they might find great difficulty with the local population and even the local political elite. South Korea, you know, is a sort of hybrid. It's a vassal state of the United States, but it's also bred people like the present president and people like Kim Dae-jung and others who saw a détente with the North as their prime political purpose, not as a servant of the United States. Perhaps that's a clash that we've yet to see happen, and perhaps it's coming. But the process has started. That's the important thing. And regional processes like this have a high success rate. You know, they have a high success rate I remember in Uganda when the East African states, following the whole devastation of Idi Amin in Uganda, that was a regional solution. They were left alone. In Latin America, when countries very rarely have been left alone by the United States, they've had regional groups that have banded together in economic formations and, if you like, protected each other. I mean, that's why they hated Hugo Chavez so much, because he promoted that. He promoted that regional solution to a region. So perhaps we're seeing the beginning of something like that. Of course, if you go to the Middle East, there would be a regional solution there. If there wasn't the United States supporting one state in its impunity and its priority in its occupation of part of it, if there was goodwill in the United States to make that a regional solution, then it'd be very difficult. There are many different competing tribal forces, but those tribal forces have mostly been reignited by the imperial powers, as we saw in Libya in 2011. So again, I suppose I'm saying that although it's probably it's so remote at the moment in the Middle East, but to see glimmers of it in Korea is hopeful.
Well, if Trump has enemies over Korea, because he may want the big grand gesture, he now has the curious enemy of the DNC that is suing him, Russia, the US Democratic Party. And this is serious, because I had to recheck it again.
Yes.
Is suing Donald Trump, Russia, and Julian Assange.
Yes, and Mickey Mouse. It's just so absurd.
As the Mueller inquiry progresses,
Within their own establishment, I say the House Intelligence Committee have ruled out, have found after months of looking into it, any conspiracy between Trump and the Russians. It was probably the Clinton cables, the Hillary Clinton cables, particularly the Podesta ones. The Podesta ones that showed that Hillary Clinton, the absolute embodiment of the Democratic establishment, that her foundation, that she knew that the force of that Saudi Arabia, Qatar, were backing ISIS. They were backing these extreme jihadist movements. And yet she and her foundation benefited from huge donations into the Clinton Foundation. And she then went on as Secretary of State to so-called negotiate the biggest arms deal that America's ever known with those states. So that's important information. That tells us how power works. That's upset them.
And Russia, of course, fighting ISIS and al-Qaeda in Syria. But does that mean then that basically Julian Assange and his WikiLeaks organization can never be forgiven by that establishment?
Well, they'll never be forgiven. I mean, we were talking earlier about good journalists are never forgiven. That's why they're good journalists. That's part of being a good journalist. But Assange has suffered so much for WikiLeaks being so good.
Have you been in touch with him?
Yes. Indirectly at the moment. I haven't. I've been in touch because he's denied visitors. He can't make phone calls. He's got no internet. It's the pressure. Pressure is on him, and every bit of his extraordinary resilience is now being called upon. It's one of those miscarriages of justice. That's too mild a term. Grotesque injustices that it should manifest right in the heart of London is a disgrace. Assange isn't even allowed to go to a hospital and come back because they won't let him back. He has the right to safe passage out of that embassy. He has a justified fear of the United States extraditing him and putting him in the kind of hellhole that Chelsea Manning endured. Only they'll probably throw away the key with Julian Assange. He's done it too well. And so for these leaks, the leak actually, I mean, WikiLeaks doesn't know where the leak came from, but the leak almost certainly came from within the Democratic National Committee, the same body that is now conducting this ridiculous action against WikiLeaks and the rest. You might as well, the same thing would be directed against the New York Times or the Washington Post when it published the Pentagon Papers back in those halcyon days when they did real journalism. If anyone needs the support of Democrats, of journalists, of those who believe in basic freedoms, freedom of speech, freedom of knowledge, freedom to know, freedom of real journalism, it's him.
John Pilger, thank you.
You're welcome.
And that's it for the show. We'll be back on Monday with renowned anti-racism campaigner Mark Wadsworth on his expulsion from Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party for bringing the party into disrepute. Till then, you can keep in touch via social media. We'll see you on Monday, 19 years to the day NATO bombed the Chinese embassy in Yugoslavia, killing or injuring 23. Beijing would call it a barbaric act.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.